So, on one occasion, the Buddha was asked, what is an appropriate or right view? Now, appropriate view is the first limb of the Eightfold Path that Catherine mentioned yesterday when she talked about appropriate effort, which is the fifth limb. And the Eightfold Path, you could say, is a whole life path of spiritual practice. But that would be a different talk. So he was asked, what is an appropriate view? And his response started off with, we have a tendency to experience the world through the polarity of is and is not, or existence and non-existence. And it might help to unpack this idea of what we mean by experience the world. If we just take this moment now, this experience, we might describe it as this person that we call Tony having these thoughts and ideas that through guttural sounds passes through the air, mysteriously hits your ear and somehow gets translated into something that makes sense to you. There's something, you know, when we think about it like that, it's actually quite extraordinary. That a thought or an idea in my head gets transmitted as a thought or an idea in your head. So that's kind of, we might say, the common experience we're having. But each and every one of us will be having our own subjective, unique experience. And that will be very much dependent on our history, our upbringing, our experiences to date. It'll also be how we're feeling at the moment, what mood we're in. But also physically how we are, if we're tired, if our body is aching, all that's going to impact our experience. But also words, although we think they're very common, they often have different nuances of meaning for each of us. So again, I might be conveying a particular idea or thought that I'm having, but you might be receiving a slightly different idea of what that thought is, depending on your history and your understanding of certain things and language and so on. So what the Buddha's pointing to here is that actually the world we experience is very much a very subjective world. It's unique to each of us. And I suspect most of us have had the experience where we find ourselves in an argument with a partner, a family member, a friend, where, you know, we were both present in the same situation, but actually our perception of it, our experience of it, is polar opposite. We see it in a very different way. And of course, how I see what happened, my experience, is obviously the real experience, the true experience. So that means I'm right. I'm sorry to say, you're wrong, and that's the end of it. And that's the situation we find ourselves in so easily. Because we think how we experience the world is actually the reality in any moment. But of course, we're all experiencing a slightly different reality. So he goes on to say that for one who experiences the world as it arises with clear discernment, they can't say it isn't or it doesn't exist. And at the same time, for that same person as he experienced the ceasing of the world as it happened, they can't say it is. They can't say it exists. And he says, what we tend to do is we tend to then fixate on our attachments, our clingings, and our biases. But what he teaches, he says, is a middle way between these two dead ends, these two extremes. Son Zen has its own very idiosyncratic way of expressing this same thing. And what I'd like to do is read a poem by a Chinese master from about 600 AD, who is considered to be the third founding teacher of the tradition. And it's called The Mind of Absolute Trust. The great way isn't difficult for those who are unattached to their preferences. Let go of longing and aversion, and everything will be perfectly clear. When you cling to a hairbreadth of distinction, heaven and earth are set apart. If you want to realize the truth, don't be for or against. The struggle between good and evil is the primal disease of the mind. Not grasping the deeper meaning, you just trouble your mind's serenity. As vast as infinite space, it is perfect and lacks nothing. But because you select and reject, you can't perceive its true nature. Don't get entangled in the world. Don't lose yourself in emptiness. Be at peace in the oneness of things, and all errors will disappear by themselves. If you don't live the Tao, you fall into assertion or denial. Asserting that the world is real, you are blind to its deeper reality. Denying that the world is real, you are blind to the selflessness of all things. The more you think about these matters, the farther you are from the truth. Step aside from all thinking, and there is nowhere you can't go. Return into the root, you find the meaning. Chasing appearances, you lose their source. At the moment of profound insight, you transcend both appearance and emptiness. Don't keep searching for the truth. Just let go of your opinions. So Zen articulates it through this idea of having no opinions or no preferences. And of course, we need to take that not too literally, because of course we can't navigate the world without opinions. You know, the idea of coming on a retreat, you had to have some sort of opinion that it would be a worthwhile thing to do, otherwise you wouldn't come. So we have these opinions. But the problem is, we start to fixate them. We start to turn them into this is how things are. And they start to actually, if you like, guide how we view the world, or colour how we view the world. So when we ask this question, part of what we're doing is we're coming to the moment aware that we're going to bring past perceptions, past ideas, past beliefs to it, but holding them lightly. And actually, rather than thinking we know how the situation is, what it's pointing us to is, what is it don't I know here? What is it that's different to how I think it is? Because it's in that space we have the opportunity to find something new, a new way of responding, a new way of experiencing the world. So when we ask this question, or when we do any Buddhist practice for that matter, what we come upon is change. As we sit here during the day, we notice the arising and the ceasing of experience, that it's continuously in change. And this, actually, until we develop a taste for the bittersweetness of impermanence, is actually very discomforting. Because what it points to is there's nothing in our experience we can hold on to, we can grasp at. There's no ground of security. So our tendency then is to try to fix things, fixate them, make them permanent, make them solid, have somewhere where we can grasp hold of and say, ah, at least that doesn't change. And the question is asking us and inviting us into the experience of change, into the experience that actually this is how it is to be a human being. So how it is to experience life. that there is nothing we can hold on to. And in the face of that, how do we respond? The second thing we start to notice is that everything is arising dependent on conditions. That they're, as they say in Zen, they're empty or they're selfless. I suspect none of you have sat here today and thought, oh, I know what I'd like right now. Maybe some aching knees or some aching shoulders. Or maybe I'll just bring that thought to mind that's going to start causing me a lot of angst and grief and make me feel miserable. We don't choose these things to happen to us. They kind of arise unbidden. And they arise out of conditions. You know, the fact that we're sitting here trying to keep still for quite a number of hours during the day is going to cause a certain amount of discomfort in the body. The body doesn't like to stay still and unmoving for long periods of time. When we get still, when we get quiet, the mind just tends to throw things out. And we can become fixated on those. So all these things that arise, all these experiences, aren't who we are. They're just what's coming and going. The problem again is the fixating. As soon as we try to hold on to the pleasant experience, or as soon as we try to push away and get rid of the unpleasant experience, we're stuck. We're like Velcro. We stick to it. And then we kind of fixate around it and we build more and more experience. And as Katrin talked about, we have this building of what they call papancha. And I think papancha is a really lovely onomatopoeic word. It really has this feel of the mind that's just starting to spin and go round and round in circles and amplifying the experience we're having. So again, the question, coming back to the body, mindfulness, is asking us just to release, relax, let go, and just come back to the changing moment. And the third thing we start to notice is that actually we tend to be very opinionated people. We have opinions about everything. I'm like this, you're like that, this is my group. That group, they're other, they're different, they're a threat. And so much, this is how life should be like, it's not okay that it's like that. We have opinions about everything. And it's, again, like I said, it's not that we shouldn't have opinions, but are those opinions helpful? Do they lead to our well-being and others' well-being? Or actually do they cause harm? And what we discover is a lot of the habitual opinions we have actually cause quite a bit of harm. Something that many of us struggle with, and I struggled with over my life, is low self-esteem. That sense of not being good enough or not being able to do things right, or that striving for perfection. And actually, that's just an opinion, a belief. The belief or the opinion that I'm not good enough is an opinion. But when that opinion engages, it causes an awful lot of angst. The pain and suffering we cause ourselves when we view ourselves through that opinion is, you know, can be very, very harsh and very, very uncomfortable. So we're called, again within this practice, to start to challenge our opinions and our beliefs. To start to look at them in a fresh light. Are they a really accurate and helpful way of looking at life? Of seeing myself, seeing others? Or are they actually harmful? Do they cause problems? And if they do, how can I start to shift that? How can I start to let go of those opinions, those preferences, those beliefs? And actually cultivate ones which are more useful, more helpful. So, the practice of Son is very much this practice of engaging with our experience as it arises moment by moment, But with this curiosity, this questioning, this sense of actually not what I know about this moment, but what don't I know about this moment. And it's in that space of what I don't know that there's a possibility of a different response, of a different way of being in the world. Rather than shaping it from the comfort of our habitual ways of seeing it. Because we have to be honest about it, there is a comfort to the way we see the world. It gives us a sense of security. It may not lead to a very pleasant sense of the world, but there's a sense of security because there's something we can hold on to. And that sense of groundlessness is actually quite a difficult place for us to inhabit, that things change. So within the tradition, they talk about three qualities on top of compassion, which is, if you like, the underlying quality. Three qualities that are indispensable to the practice of Son. And these are usually translated as great faith, great doubt, and great determination. I think a more useful way of thinking of them and a more accurate way of translating them is as trust, questioning, and courage. And I'd like to just explore each of these in a little bit more detail. But before I do, the great that they tag on at the beginning is really referring to the fact that these are qualities that we develop, that we cultivate, and that they can become stronger in our lives. And it can become a point where they become very stable, unshakable in our lives. That sense of trust, that sense of life being questionable, and that sense of courage to meet life, however it's showing up, becomes unshakable. So trust, I think trust is a much more useful way of translating what is usually translated as faith, because the practice doesn't actually require us to believe anything in particular. And faith often comes with that baggage that there's a set of things we have to believe. Often things that we can't, if you like, prove in our experience, but also we're not allowed to question. So what is it we learn to trust in? And the Buddha, there's a very famous story of the Buddha being asked by the Kalamas, this group of people, where could they place their trust? Because at the time there were a lot of teachers going around India, all giving their own different kind of take on what life was about and how to live life and what practices to do. And they were asking, you know, which teacher can we trust? What teaching can we trust? What sacred text can we trust? And the Buddha's response wasn't to kind of go, well, don't trust any of those, but you can trust me, and you can trust what I say. What he actually said was, don't depend on or don't put your trust in any sacred text, any teacher, any teaching, any practice. And he used this phrase a lot in his teaching, ehipasiko, come see. This idea that test it out in your own experience. Look at it in your own experience and see, where does it lead? Is it something I can actually trust in from my own experience? And he gave two criteria for exploring it. The first one was, does it lead when you actually engage it, when you practice with it, does it lead to well-being? Does it lead to happiness? Does it lead to non-harming and the benefit of self and others? And he said, if it does, then you can trust in it. And the second one was, does it lead to ill will? Does it lead to harm? Does it lead to ill-being and cruelty? And if it does, discard it, put it aside, and kind of put your trust in it. So as we start to explore these practices, questioning, but also practice in the wider sense, so not just what we do in the cushion, but this sense of how we live our lives, the ethical guidelines by which we engage our lives, but also our understanding, the way we view the world, the kind of beliefs and opinions we bring to how we engage with the world. So it encompasses our whole life. When we start to engage with this, and we find, as I hope you do, and certainly as I've found in my experience, that it actually does lead to greater well-being, it does lead to causing less harm in the world, it is of benefit to me and others, then we can actually start to put more and more of our trust in the practice. We become more confident in the practice. And we can actually start to take more refuge in the practice. And this can often be a useful thing to explore for yourself. Where do I put my refuge when things are difficult? Do I go and turn on the TV? Do I go to the fridge and find lots of sweet snacks? Where do I look for refuge when things are difficult? And as we pointed out last night, it's not that that is necessarily wrong. You know, sometimes things become overwhelming and we need to find a way of actually just de-stressing the system. And putting on an uplifting, a funny film can really just relax the whole being. But if it becomes our habitual default way of always approaching any difficulty, then it just becomes a way of distracting. So where do we put our trust? And again, this is something that we can really see in our experience and start to gain more and more trust in. I remember having this experience many years ago. I was at home on my own and I was feeling incredibly lonely and sorry for myself. A particular relationship I was in was not going too well, and there was kind of feelings of abandonment and not being seen and all this kind of going on, and a lot of storying going on. And rather than kind of just in that moment, as I might normally do, going to the TV and, you know, distracting myself, I just sat with it and I just stayed with it. And I just kept coming back to the felt experience of it. And I noticed myself going into the story again. And I just come back into that felt experience. And it was uncomfortable. You know, the feeling of loneliness and feeling sorry for oneself is unpleasant. But I stayed and I stayed and I kept just allowing it to be there. And there came a point where it just, after 20 or 30 minutes, it just dissolved. And there was this sense of joy, delight, release. It just filled the space for a few moments. And a sense that actually loneliness wasn't something to fear. That actually I had the tools, but also the ability to meet it and allow it to be. And that's the second area of trust that we start to develop. And possibly even more important, that we are able to do this. That this ability doesn't reside out there in that teacher or that guru or that monk and nun, but actually it also resides in here. And I think I mentioned it briefly. They often refer to it in the tradition as Buddha nature. That this ability to actually be awake to and meet our experience with kindness, with compassion, and allow it to transform as it will if we just leave it alone, is an innate ability for each and every one of us. It's something each and every one of you in this room is capable of doing. It's just becoming aware of that, starting to trust in that, and actually putting the practice into operation. Just again and again and again, just coming back to the moment, to those qualities of kindness, trusting oneself, compassion, of allowing. And however many times you go off, you just come back to that. And slowly, slowly, we start to see that actually, yes, I can do this. And we start to trust more and more in our ability and the practice as the refuge, as the stability, as the ground that we've always been looking for. That we've looked for out there in things, in relationships, in possessions, in whatever, in beliefs. That actually it rests there in that ability to be with and meet our experience. With kindness, with allowing, with spaciousness. And possibly with a very big dose of patience. Because, you know, you're not going to go home after one retreat and that's it, you have it sussed. This is a lifetime practice. What I have to meet now, as I'm, you know, visibly aging, is very, very different to what I had to meet in my life when I was in my 20s and 30s. Life continuously brings us new situations which ask of us not to grab hold of, not to become aversive to, but to just let go into and meet from this place of a spacious, kind awareness, a curious awareness. So the second quality is this quality or this attitude of questioning, which we've talked quite a lot about already. But just to say a few more things. The tradition would see the primacy of questioning as a return to what we might loosely call the life koan of the Buddha. The tradition has the myth of the Buddha seeing four sights. So he saw an aging person, he saw a sick person, he saw a corpse, and he saw what is called a sramanera, or a wandering ascetic. And again, if we kind of unpick it from the mythology, what we can start to see is actually, for the very first time in his life, the human condition and his part in the human condition of aging, sickness and death became a question for him. It became an existential inquiry for him. He became aware, I'm going to age, I'm going to get sick, and I'm going to end up a corpse just like that corpse. And again, a bit like that question that Catherine talked about yesterday, in the face of the fact that I'm going to die, but I don't know when, what do I do with my life? This question brought that same kind of sense to him. In the face of that, what am I going to do? And he decided, like the wandering ascetic he saw, to go off and search for an answer. And his teachings and his practices, we could say, are his responses to that search. They're not the answers. Each one of us is called to find, if you say, in a sense, our own answer to living with that reality of our human condition. But his teachings point to ways that we can start to engage, practices we can engage with that actually give us the tools to meet this in our life, to meet our lives fully without holding on and without rejecting. Without being for or against. And there are two little quotes I'd like to So the Zen Master Hakuin says this: at the bottom of great doubt or great questioning lies great awakening. If you doubt fully, you will awaken fully. And another teacher, Bhushan, put it this way: Great questioning, great awakening. Little questioning, little awakening. No questioning, no awakening. So very much a sense within the tradition that actually the quality of our being present in any moment, our being awake in any moment, is dependent on the degree of curiosity that's there, the degree of questioning. And it doesn't have to be formulated in terms of a question. Lots of Buddhist practitioners have that deep sense of inquiry through mindfulness practice, through metta practice, through lots of different practices. But it is that quality of inquiry, of curiosity in the moment, that actually wakes us up to the moment. Because it actually opens up the spaciousness to actually look at the moment with a freshness, with a sense of actually, what is it I don't know about this moment, rather than I know this moment already, because it's just like all these other moments I've ever experienced. And that's our tendency. So, whether it's through questioning practice like this, or you find some other way of engaging that sense of curiosity, but really bringing that sense of curiosity to your practice, that sense of actually, what is that really happening right now? What don't I know about this moment? What can I learn about this moment? Rather than trying to hold on to it or trying to get rid of it. And the final quality is the quality of courage. And in a sense, we can't do this practice without courage. I mean, the reality is that being a human being is difficult. We're really highly sensitive beings. We get impacted by the world so deeply. And it is a challenge being human. Rumi, the Sufi mystic and poet, likens being human to being a guest house. And he talks about how, you know, all these things come to visit the guest house. A meanness, a momentary awareness, a joy, hatred. They all just arrive at the doorstep of the guest house. And he talks about throwing open the door and welcoming them all in. And he also talks about how we don't know what they're clearing the pathway for, even those difficult ones. And as I described in my experience with loneliness, in my willingness to sit through and be with that, actually what it opened it up to me was a great sense of joy and release, but also actually the understanding that there isn't anything to fear in loneliness. So all these things that we try to avoid are actually potentials to be teachers for us. We can learn something about ourselves and about life that can actually be quite freeing and quite liberating. But this takes courage. You know, we like our comforts. We like things to be easeful. We like to be happy and joyful and life to just be pleasant. And you know, we often find, if we really look carefully, we can often find that in the background there can be this coming to practice with this kind of hope of some kind of eventual awakening or enlightenment, where we're cosseted by this, all this cotton wool, and life can no longer really impact us. It's all just kind of this pleasant, blissful experience. And I'm loath to burst that bubble, but I'm sorry to say it doesn't quite work like that. As Catherine said last night, the Buddha, who's, you know, this ideal that's often dangled in front of us, he suffered. He suffered from terrible back pain when he was older. He'd be in a situation like this where there's a group of people, they want him to teach, And they actually have to turn to one of his senior followers and actually say, please, can you talk to these people? I need to lie down and look after my back. I'm in too much pain. And as Catherine pointed out last night, this personification of all those things that kind of knock us off balance and destabilize us and create all that angst in our life. That in the mythology of the teachings is personified as Mara. That Mara, even after the Buddha's so-called awakening, kept appearing, kept coming back. Even on his deathbed, Mara appeared. But the difference was, rather than that being a problem, rather than being actually destabilized there, the Buddha just opened to that. He saw what was there. He met it without grasping, without aversion. And he said, I see you, Mara. It's okay, you can be there, but I'm not going to react. And Mara just slunk away. Because there was nothing to grab hold of. So, the practice, the allowing, the meeting with kindness and care, the questioning and curiosity, doesn't get rid of what it is we have to meet in life. We will still age, as the Buddha did. We will still get sick, as the Buddha did. And we will still die. But what we start to have is a different perspective, a different relationship with it, a different way of being with our experience. That is more spacious, that has more kindness in it, more curiosity, more allowing, that actually creates the freedom in the midst of. We have the space, the peace, the ease in the midst of what is difficult to bear, what is challenging. What is, at times, heart-rending. You know, what goes on in the world, sometimes what we have to see and experience ourselves, it can be heart-rending, really difficult to bear. But can we meet all of that and become, as I mentioned last night, this ABC of practice, a bigger container, able to meet and hold more and more of life. Doesn't mean we have to like it. No one's asking us to like the fact that we're in pain or that someone close to us has died. But can we be okay with that's how life is and find our way of actually meeting it in a way that we don't get stuck and fixated there? Because that's where our freedom lies. So thank you for your attention. Actually, I forgot, but I was going to finish with another little poem from another Zen master. And I think it's nice to finish with this. And this is by a teacher called Layman Pang. So rather than being some great master monk, he was actually a layman, a woman like ourselves, practicing within a lay life. And he says this: my daily affairs are quite ordinary, but I'm in total harmony with them. I don't hold on to anything, don't reject anything, nowhere an obstacle or conflict. Who cares about wealth and honour? Even the poorest thing shines. My miraculous power and spiritual activity, drawing water and carrying wood. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.